if you want to be a guest, please email me. I have received so many emails of people that are excited and passionate about being a guest on this show. The process is time consuming. I go through about an hour long pre-interview and I determine where you'd fit best in the season. So if you've gone through the pre-interview process, or we've messaged back and forth via email and haven't gone through the pre-interview process, I'm not ignoring you. I promise. There's just a lot on my plate and I am one person. So that being said, I look forward to talking with every one of you that is interested in being on this podcast. Y'all are amazing and I honestly could not do this podcast without the support that I receive from each one of you. So thank you so much.
I think just telling children, I'm going to trust you. You have your autonomy, but we are going to sit down and talk and we're going to have really honest conversations. And I will love, if you murdered somebody, I would be there in prison visiting you, because you will always be my child, no matter what. I think that's so much more effective than reading their diaries to try to find out if there's something you need to know.
Yeah.
Is it always going to work? No, things slip through the cracks. Kids do things. But gosh, if I had any parental advice to give from my experience as a parent, it's that just at the end of the day, no matter how mad your children make you, and they will make you mad, just be like, you know what? This is just a bump in the road. I love you desperately. I will do anything for you. I would die for you, because that's my job. And my parents used to hold money over our heads all the time. Like, we spent this money for this vacation. I never did that to my children.
Welcome to the Focus on Your Own Family podcast. Fundamentalist evangelicalism impacted a generation. We survived physical, psychological, mental, and spiritual abuse. We survived the Focus on the Family movement, and we want to talk about it. Trigger warning, guests will be sharing stories of domestic violence, child abuse, and animal abuse. Please listen with caution. This is Paul. Here is his story. Hello, Paul. Do you prefer Pastor Paul or Paul?
Well, Paul for sure. But I've always felt like if somebody needs that affirmation of having somebody in a pastoral position love on them and be kind, then I never tell people, oh, don't call me Pastor Paul. But yeah, Paul is great.
I am so happy that you are here. You are the host of Evangelical-ish, and that I know I've
co-host.
Told you this before. Co-host. Yeah, I'm so sorry. Co-host. I know I mentioned this to you before. That podcast was truly a, however you look at it, God send, universe send. During a really difficult time, I was able to listen to people that still held on to their faith and were willing to dissect and bravely talk about the aspects of the evangelical movement and religion that were detrimental to them. And that was really helpful, because I felt like I had people that were with me and behind me, even though I didn't know them. Thank you for that. It just, the three of you were really impactful in my life during a difficult time. So I appreciate all three of you.
Thank you. That just means so much that we... You know, we were just three people who had no idea what we were doing, sitting in front of microphones and processing life. And it definitely helped change us and speak to us. And so that it impacted you positively just means the world. So thank you.
You are welcome. So I am honestly very excited to get to know you more and get to know your story more. I know we've had a couple conversations prior to this, but I didn't do a lot of research on you. And a lot of times when people have a larger platform and they're well known in places, I tend to just dig in and do a lot of research. I listen to my instincts on this one. I'm like, no, I just want to sit and have a conversation with you rather than have a rap sheet of your accolades in front of me. I would love to hear how your expertise is so much on, you talk a lot about Christian nationalism and where our country's going and where that shift was. But I'd like to pull back to when you were younger and talk about your upbringing with your dad being, you were a preacher's kid, and just the people that you were surrounded by. I'd love to hear that. And then how Dobson's leaked in there and really the birth of this nationalism. So if you're comfortable, I'd love to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. My dad was a pastor of some renown in the Assemblies of God, if people know anything about that denomination. And it's basically Baptist, but we raise our hands and speak in tongues. And Baptists aren't going to heaven because they're once saved, always saved. That was the theology I grew up with. And Jesus is going to come any second. And if you're, you know, masturbating, you won't go, you know, kind of thing. So that was our origin. And so as that, I did get to meet a lot of the big names, and I love, you know, I have this story in my life of, you know, we met Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. They were in our house at the very beginning of PTL. And I love to tell people this, like, they were wonderful, sincere people who truly thought, and I believe were, you know, doing something good and doing something good inspired by their religious faith. And I think we mock that at our peril. Because particularly Jim and Tammy Faye, I think, are such an important story of how did these wonderful people who were dirt poor for God, literally, like living out of their car and coming to some podunk Missouri town where I live to raise money so they could do this thing, and became the people they became. Mm-hmm. How did that happen? That is really the story of evangelicalism, of how power and money does corrupt absolutely. But yeah, so we had them, and I got to meet Jimmy Swaggart before the affair. And most people may not know C.M. Ward, but C.M. Ward was a huge radio guy in the Christian world. And I think, and C.M. Ward used to stay at our home on a regular basis, and he used to tell us, like, marry a woman that has eyebrows, because that means she sweats and has sweat buckets above her eyes and will do work. You know, he would tell me and my brothers things like that. And so, yeah, that's, I think, really being around a person like C.M. Ward, watching my parents who voted for Jimmy Carter because he was born again, and then really soured on him, I think, because he was wimpy. I think that's really where we see this Christian nationalism starting to take root. And I always kind of joke, I grew up in a household where Ronald Reagan and God were neck and neck as the greatest beings ever in the universe, with Reagan pulling slightly ahead. And yeah, so that's the roots of where I came from.
When was James Dobson introduced to you? Obviously not in the physical sense, but just, when did you really begin to hear about him and Falwell and the Moral Majority?
Well, you know, of course, Falwell was became huge in the late 70s. And, you know, began weaponizing abortion because he hated Jimmy Carter for the Carter administration trying to force Falwell to integrate his college campus, Liberty College, which is now Liberty University. And if people don't know that story, they need to go read it. Like,
yes,
Protestants were pro Roe v. Wade, mm-hmm, all the way to the late 70s. And it was Jerry Falwell Sr. and a Republican operative named Paul Weyrich who said, hey, we can weaponize this abortion thing and manipulate Christians to vote our way. So that transition was happening in my parents. I can look back now and see. And so Dobson came on the scene through that, his association with Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, Dobson, Francis Schaeffer, Frank Schaeffer. Those are the guys that were sitting around the table with Jerry Falwell saying, you know, this is how we're going to make America a Christian nation. But Francis Schaeffer's son now is out there saying, hey, these were cynical, you know, people like James Dobson, they were cynical, bad people. Mm-hmm. Like he was sitting at the table and they knew they were cynical, bad people. Like I can say Jim and Tammy Faye, I legitimately believe they were trying to do good and got corrupted. But according to Schaeffer, that's not the truth of these guys around the table. They knew what they were doing was corrupting a religion, and that has now pervaded the evangelicalism that we knew.
So at what, and we'll talk about later how these people have been able to get in such close proximity to power, to presidential nominees, to presidents, to world leaders. But what were your thoughts while you were watching this, while you were a young parent? What was that like?
Oh man. You know, I listened to Caleb, and I would listen to, you know, Focus on the Family and Dobson stuff. And I have always been a healthy cynic. As a kid, I just say I am the kid from the Emperor's New Clothes fable who was like, wait a second, the Emperor's naked. I've always been that kid. And so I listened to Focus on the Family. It's looking back now, I was so double-minded because I really did think James Dobson was just full of shit. But I listened to it all the time because I thought I had to, and I thought this mm-hmm. had to be truth. So I had this part of me of like, this is nonsense. And the other part of me that, and I apologize to your audience for saying shit. You gave me permission to do it.
Yeah, go for it. Don't apologize. You're fine.
As a pastor, I used to say from the pulpit, you know, a cuss word a day keeps religious demons away. So, you know, I love the freedom to cuss now. So I do it a lot. But yeah, so I was fully double-minded. I felt I had to listen to this stuff. I agreed with it at the same time thinking men like James Dobson, I'm like, oh, he's full of shit. And I assumed he was grifting money and probably having an affair. And, you know, because growing up, these are the men I saw, and that's who they were, pious. And then they get at the table and say horrible things and be, you know, grabbing their secretary's ass. And, you know, mm-hmm. so I knew these were not good people, but I still felt like, okay, God uses bad people. And so as a young parent, you know, when I had kids, I was like, these are the greatest human beings who have ever existed on the planet. Mm-hmm. There is nothing wrong in them whatsoever, which is why I hate the original sin theology so much. But, you know, my wife and I both were under the influence of a religion that was under the influence of men like James Dobson. And so I died inside at the idea of spanking our kids, but my wife was convinced that, you know, our kids would become axe murderers if we didn't. So, and she would admit this now, like she nagged and browbeat me into it and shamed me. Like I'm a terrible parent if I don't spank my kids. And so I think I spanked my daughter like 3 times. And she was one who was like, I don't care. Spank me. Yeah, great. You do that, you know? And I was very much like, okay, this is what you did. We agree that it was wrong. And so I'm going to give you 2 swats and then we're going to hug it out. And then she would be like, well, do whatever you want, you know? And then I would hug her and she would get as rigid as she could. And she was not going to be hugged, you know? And that was that process. But our son was just this little sweethearted little guy. And every time, you know, just if I looked at him wrong, he would just melt in a mm-hmm. puddle on the floor and just think, I'm such a bad kid. And so spanking him was so evil. It was so horrible. I could not have done a worse thing than committing violence against that child and my daughter too. I'm not saying she deserved it, but seeing his reaction, mm-hmm. I was like, I'm sorry. I just told my wife, I will never do that again. And I felt like a really shitty parent doing terrible things to my children because James Dobson had convinced and built a mindset. When the New Testament talks about principality, I think it's groupthink. It's a mindset. We have to spank our kids or we're not being godly parents. And so I hate James Dobson for that. I hate him that he ever had any part in enticing me to commit violence against my children.
What do you think it, James Dobson particularly went for the heart of women? If you listen to the way he talks, I don't even have to say this. When you listen to the way he talks, because he's still, I feel like somehow his voice is just ingrained in me, but he doesn't speak with an authoritative voice. He speaks softly, and the way that he talks, it's just, he'll gently, like there's just, it's, he makes himself feel very safe and approachable. I'll never forget him saying youngsters. He would always say youngster, those little youngsters. There was something so appealing to him. He was so appealing to mothers and to women. He made them believe that he understood them, that he saw them, and that he got their heart. Do you feel like you saw that? What do you think the psychology was behind that? And were the others like that too? Falwell, Schaefer, were they similar to that?
I wrestle with these things a lot coming out, coming out of evangelicalism, because I can honestly say, like, we were closely tied to Bethel Church in Redding, California. And I would be an absolute liar if I didn't say Bill Johnson, Chris Vallotton, these people had a profound impact on my heart and life. They actually kind of pulled me out of my Assemblies of God mindset. And so in a lot of ways, I think what you're talking about is, you know, all preaching, all is a tough word, but even as a preacher myself, you learn those manipulation tools. Like, I'm going to tell you something really important now, and I'm going to pause. I'm going to come down to this whisper, and I'm going to look you in the eye. You know, we learn those manipulation tactics. Dobson was he a psychiatrist? I know Dr. Dobson.
He was a psychologist. I don't think that he was... And I could be wrong on this. I don't think he was an MD because he wasn't a big proponent for medication. I don't remember him talking a whole lot about that, like treating people medicinally.
I wondered if he was really a psychologist or a psychiatrist, or if he had some pseudoscience doctoral degree. I'm not sure.
He got his degree from I think it was like a private university it's in California.
Okay.
And that's when he was doing some stuff for Paul Popino.
I think he would understand some level what he was doing was manipulation. Like, I'm going to take on the grandfatherly doctor pose and use it to manipulate my audience. I think there's a lot of Christian leaders who just have adopted that style from watching others, and we don't probably aren't fully aware what we're doing is mind manipulation, or that playing pads in a worship service is in fact a, you know, sort of groupthink hypnotic technique to get people in a very malleable mindset. So, but with the education that I think Dobson probably had, I think he probably was aware, like, this is where my bread is going to be buttered, and this is how I'm going to be able to influence the audience. And I can't help but think, again, having met some of these bigs of the bigs of our lineage, religious lineage, that there was a cynicism behind what they were doing. They believed ultimately it was for God's good, but God would forgive them for using very manipulative tactics to get there.
Yeah, I actually feel like you described the Christian nationalism, white evangelicalism movement right there. Just that it doesn't matter what we do, as long as we get the result of people saved. But we don't, in the process, you've caused so much abuse that they're not even saved in the way that the Bible even talked about. Because they're saved under coercion and manipulation and abuse. You did a beautiful job of just summing it up right there.
Well, I mean, it truly is. If democracy is not serving to bring the kingdom of God into God's favorite country, which is the United States,
of course,
then democracy has to go. And I was reading, I still read the Bible. I love the Bible. I don't see it anywhere near the way I used to, but I was reading along one day, and every once in a while you read something, you're like, how did I never see this before in here? And I think it's in Luke 11. I hit this passage. It's right after Jesus has raised Lazarus from the dead, and it's creating this ruckus. And so the religious guys, and by the way, not Jewish leaders per se, I think people of the Jewish heritage who were corrupting the Jewish religion the same way evangelicals now are corrupting mm-hmm. Christianity. Mm-hmm. So I want to be very clear. This is not an anti-Semitic stance. So I never use the word Pharisee or as a pejorative or anything. But some religious guys who had some political power at the time and thought their job was to make Israel great again, because that's what God needed to happen on earth, are talking, and they say this line in Luke 11, if Jesus keeps doing what he's doing, people are going to believe in him, and we will lose our temple and lose our country. They were literally religious nationalists. Like, if people truly believe in Jesus, like, I can hear James Dobson and Jerry Falwell saying this, if they really believe in the real Jesus, we lose. We mm-hmm. lose our religion, and we lose our country. And so therefore we have to kill Jesus. And Caiaphas makes this famous statement of, like, if one man has to die to help a whole people, well, so be it. So he could justify murder in pursuit of making his country great again, because that's what God needed to happen for God's plan to be available on earth. So really good people, really close friends of mine who I know are smart, loving people, now post on Facebook that guillotines should be set up on Pennsylvania Avenue for Democrats. That's how it happens. You start to believe any means to that end of having God in charge of the country is okay and worthwhile and demanded by this jealous God who loves genocide as a way to get his purposes done on earth. Scary. It's truly scary stuff.
It is. Because these are, I think of my parents, I think of, especially my dad. My dad is educated, intelligent. And I think of when I remember the shift of all of a sudden, it's like somebody just, he became a different person. Conversations just seemed, growing up, circling, going back to Dobson, because we'll get into that shift in a little bit, but growing up, my mom was the one that was very heavily into Dobson and Joyce Meyer, never Beth Moore.
I know, you're the strong-willed child, Stephanie. Oh, come on.
Oh, I am. I was talking, my husband and I were laughing about a story that I told him last night. He had heard the story many times. And the thing with being the strong-willed child is your parents, this isn't just me, this is across the board. Parents still to this day like to tout how strong-willed the kid was, and then how hard they had to work to discipline and just beat the will out of this child. So my mom still has the spoons. And
oh my gosh.
Oh yeah. She'd hold it up. She'd be like, what was this used for? Because that's just her. My dad will make some off-the-wall comment. But one of the things that my dad would do when they got past the time of room, so room raids were a big thing. If my parents felt like I wasn't being obedient, or I was getting to, this would be like teen years, they would go in my room. When I was a child, they go in my room and they would take all of my belongings and put them in trash bags and then put them up in the attic, like above, and the crawl space was in their room, and they'd put them there. And then when I was obedient enough, I could get my belongings back. What was interesting is they forgot that some of the stuff was there. And when they moved, when I was 18, that's a whole other story, there were still bags of my belongings from when I was a child that they had forgotten about. I don't know if I've earned them back yet. My guess is based on my content, I probably have not.
God, this story is so horrifying. I'm dying over here.
And I want
to go punch your
horrifying.
Parents in the face.
It's horrifying. Then those shifted into room raids where if I was just getting too mouthy or just asserting my my rebellious spirit. They would go into my room and they would do a full FBI room raid, read my journals, read my.
I was going to say Dobson used to tell parents to read the diaries of their children.
Yep.
That's horrifying.
Yeah. And they would spread it out over their bed and they'd go through it one by one. And this is where your sin is. This is what like all this. It was a whole thing.
Parents, let me just say, and I'm no expert parent, but do not read your child's diaries and journals. They need a safe space where they can express themselves. And if you're reading their stuff, I know you think it's you're saving them from something, but you're not. Do not ever do that. Sorry, didn't mean
to. Hijack whatever. I stand with that too. I have teenagers and I can't imagine just invading their privacy like that. We do have stuff on their phone that if alerts come through, especially if one of their friends is talking about suicidal ideation or something like that, that we do see that. And they know that at any given moment, I can take their phone and I can do a phone check just to make sure, hey, we're not doing things that are bullying people or that sort of thing. But I trust my kids. They're good. They're really good kids. I see how they advocate for people and they love people. And are they mouthy? Yep, they're my kids. Are they strong-willed? I have three strong-willed children and I could not be happier because I know that they're going to go far in life and I'm not going to beat that out of them. But,
stay with us. We'll be right back.
Thank you to those that have reached out with your support. Whether you have left a review, if you haven't left a review, this would be a really, really good time to leave a review. Read every single one of them. So thank you. And for those that are subscribers to my Patreon, thank you. It means so much. One of the new features that I am adding for my paid Patreon subscribers is the chat feature. And this is just a way that we can all continue this conversation that we're having in the podcast. And if you are not a paid subscriber, unfortunately, the chat feature won't be available to you, but you can be a free subscriber and you'll just get the weekly newsletters. Y'all are amazing. And I honestly could not do this podcast without the support that I receive from each one of you. So thank you so much.
If I can interject,
please.
I'm not going to critique you for having that software on the phones because, there are real threats out there of, of predators. Many of them white, cis, hetero, Christian men. Most of them, I should say.
Yes.
But again, I not the greatest parent in the world or anything, but I one thing my children tell me now, my daughter's 24, my son is 20. They say, through it all, you did good things and bad things. And we now let our children really tell the things we did that hurt them. They say one thing we knew was our dad loved us no matter what. Like there's nothing we could do. And I couldn't say that of my parents growing up. I was convinced and am still convinced that my parents were afraid of me and didn't like me because of how they had been taught, children ought to be. And I was always rebellious and I was always a question asker. So I think there is a tension that we have to weigh out between like, I'm going to let my child have their privacy and their autonomy so that we can build a trust that instead of me reading something in their journal that makes me intervene in their life, that they'll actually come talk to me about it or that I can ask and they'll tell me. And, at the end of the day, I think my daughter would be okay with me saying this, I think she had her first sexual encounter with a boy at 16, 17. And it killed her that she couldn't tell her mom. Like she's like, I hate you guys because I couldn't tell my mom that this happened. And that's the stuff that crushes me. And so I think just telling children, I'm going to trust you. You have your autonomy, but we are going to sit down and talk and we're going to have really honest conversations. And I will love, if you murdered somebody, I would be there in prison visiting you because you will always be my child, no matter mm-hmm. what. I think that's so much more effective than reading their diaries to try to find out if there's something you need to know.
Yeah.
Is it always going to work? No, things slip through the cracks. Kids do things. But gosh, if I had any parental advice to give from my experience as a parent, it's that just at the end of the day, no matter how mad your children make you, and they will make you mad, just be like, you know what? This is just a bump in the road. I love you desperately. I will do anything for you. I would die for you because that's my job. You know, and my parents used to hold money over our heads all the time. Like, we spent this money for Thanks. This vacation. Why? I never did that to my children. Even to this day, we're still helping our children out as they're going to school and stuff. And they'll be like, and I love their hearts. They're like, oh, I'm so sorry that you still have to support me and pay my car insurance or something like that. And I'm just like, that's my job. What are you talking about? That's what I'm supposed to do as a parent. And I look back at my dad now and I just say, you asshole, you know, you were beating me up and making me guilty for doing what you were supposed to do as a parent, you know? So yeah. I just want to tell my children all the time, you know, no, giving, I sorry to keep rambling on, but they, you know,
don't apologize.
When my kids were really small, I set them down and told them, hey, when your grandparents say to you, Santa's watching, you better be good or you're not going to get presents. That's a total lie. You are getting presents no matter how you behave. Because we and Santa and Jesus love giving you gifts. It is mm-hmm. our pure joy to give you gifts. And I've had people tell me that that's really bad parenting, but that made a mark on my children. And so when my in-laws or somebody would say, Santa's watching, my kids would look at me and we would wink at each other and like, nah, that's not true. And I just think those things were moments that my kids felt valued mm. and seen. And I don't think there's anything we can do better than that. You know, that out of, you know, children are to be seen and not heard is just bullshit. There just has to be times when we say, who you are is the most important thing in the world to me. There's nothing more important because you are the complete crafter of their identity. So I'll stop preaching now, but gosh, it just,
that's keep going. So much you're fine. as soon as you talked about finances, it hits home. I talk about that, and that's very common for kids that grew up fundy. I'm 39, and I talk about this with I'm still close. She listens to the podcast. So her name is Julie and I love her. And we were put in the cradle together. Anyway, we talk about that, how finances were such a big deal in our home. We never had a working car because my parents trusted Jesus and gave their money to the church. And so that was always very challenging growing up, just not knowing if you were going to make it to your destination because your car was going to break down. And also having things like my parents pulled me out of public school and put me in private school. And at the time, I was supposed to see that as a privilege. I go to private school. However, I would have that held over my head. Do you know that I have to work two jobs just to send you to school? Yeah. It would be nice if you were grateful. School's been free my whole life. Why are we doing this? I was fine. But they didn't like that I was not supervised at public school. My mom worked in all of my schools except for my high school, my public high school. And so when she got a job working at the private school, I was pulled out so that she could make sure I was a good Christian girl.
I mean, doesn't this speak to our view of God, right?
Yes. Yes.
A God that created us. And then demands ongoing thankfulness that he created us, or else. And I didn't ask to be created. I had no say in that. Why do I have to keep thanking you for this? Why? And this idea then of this good Father in heaven who demands worship for everything good that happens because I'm not capable of anything good and demands no blame for anything bad. All bad is my fault for free will. Well, of course, our parents are like, you should be grateful and thank me for putting food on the table instead of saying, no, that's my responsibility and my honor. And I, you know, we're here talking today because you showed up on my FYP and I was like, wow, this is really good stuff. And so I just want to tell your mom, I want to tell your mom that that strong-willed child had a purpose and we're seeing it play out in front of our eyes and it's absolutely beautiful. So
thank you.
It is
very healing and also terrifying, not terrifying, upsetting when you realize, like you were saying, putting words to that, a child's job is not to thank their parents for doing their job.
No.
Period. It's not a woman's job to admonish a husband who is, or a parent who's a male, for doing his job as being a parent. No, he's not watching the kids, he's parenting. But that's how we were brought up. We, meaning you and I and so many others. I'd like to circle back, the thing that my husband and I were laughing about, we went on a glorious rabbit trail, which I love. This is why I love doing this. Sean is my husband. Sean and I were laughing last night just because my dad, when I was a teenager, I was like 17. He did this a couple times, if I remember correctly. And two of the times, the only times that I remember this, I happened to be brought home by a youth leader. And these two youth leaders, a few years apart, very much remember these occurrences. And I came home and my door was removed from my room. And my dad said, you wouldn't clean your room. So we took your door. And so now you can be embarrassed at the pigsty, the slob mess that you've made. And I looked at him and I said, okay, that's fine. And I got my blankets and my pillow, because it was like nighttime, like I was supposed to get ready for bed. I grabbed my blankets and pillow and I dried out the bathtub and I was like, I'm sleeping in the bathroom then.
Oh my.
And he just was like, you've got to be kidding me. My door was back on my room within 20 minutes because it wasn't going to work. But it's interesting.
And you know what? That's just, that's something so powerful in you. Mm-hmm. And that parents, I get why we find that challenging as parents, but to not nurture that and say, this is something brilliant and beautiful in you just makes me super angry. On your behalf and the behalf of all other strong-willed children in the world.
Thank you. I realize now that what Dobson actually was teaching kids, Dobson taught an entire generation of parents how to hate their children and call it love. And how that impacted me personally is I learned at a very young age how to manipulate, how to lie, and believe my lies. That's the thing, is I could just build on top of them because that is the only avenue that I had to freedom. But I think Dobson encouraged me to be defiant. I had to fight so much harder for autonomy. Mm-hmm. And that's not a healthy thing at all. Now it serves me now because I know how I can fight now, right? I was standing up to my parents at such a young age, even though it was scary. But now I can look at people that are bullies or at public action and that sort of thing. And I can stand up and I can say, okay, I can fight in a good way, right? I can get involved in activism. Sorry, words are hard.
Well, you're talking about deep stuff.
It is interesting. That is something that I had to deconstruct from. Is that I'm safe. I don't need to lie to be free anymore. That's sad that so many of us had to do that just so that they could earn their parents' love.
I really, sad. I believe, and I do life coaching with people now, and when we're brought up in an environment that is traumatic rather than giving us identity, which is the purpose of parents, is to give their child a firm self-understanding and self-identity, that love your neighbor as yourself carries the command to love yourself, that you have to love yourself to be able to love others well, creates a situation where the child understands, I am an abomination. You know, I am a problem in the world. And so lying and being fake and putting up masks and covering up are survival, that you cannot survive without those methodologies. It teaches us to be dishonest externally and internally, to hate externally and to hate internally. And it's the opposite of who Jesus was. Absolute opposite. It's horrifying to me to hear those stories. And what a powerful thing you just said, that Dobson taught a generation of parents to hate their children. I mean, it's, and I believe when we talk about Christian nationalism, that is in many ways the result of the things men like James Dobson did, because we're a people group and a huge, influential, powerful one in the United States without any sense of personal identity. That's all been stolen by our theology. And so a huckster reality TV host comes along and says, I'm your retribution. I'm the one who can save you. And we as a people have been looking for that strong man to come and save us for a long time. So we easily fall for it because of things done by people like James Dobson. And I don't think that's even a centimeter of a stretch to say so. These are the roots of why we evangelicals are the easiest to be manipulated with conspiracy theories and all of these other things, because we believe in the ultimate conspiracy theory, that God is, you know, going to come back in the clouds and take us out of here one day. And then we get to laugh at everybody else on earth. You know, we have a massive identity crisis in America. And when I don't have a personal identity, I'm a human. So I have to find value and purpose and safety. And so I'll find it in a pack somewhere. I'm an animal. I'm a pack animal. So I'll find a community that will call me safe and valuable and purposeful. And then I'll defend that community at all costs, because I don't have strength in my own identity to step out of that community. And for those of us who were the strong-willed, rebellious children saying, wait, this doesn't make sense, now we know what that feels like to be excommunicated and on the outside, but we can't accept any other truth than that. But I think for most Americans, it's like give me avoidance coping mechanisms and let me stay in dissonance because I'm afraid. I don't have the identity to stand on my own.
It's so true. I was thinking as you were talking that one of the things that Dobson and the Fathers of Nationalism did is they, through grooming and indoctrination, helped parents of that generation, helped the boomer generation, and down, even down from that, right? They showed that they helped them chip away the humanity from their children. And if you can take the humanity from your own children, you can take it away from anyone. And they're successfully taking away humanity from anybody. And parents don't think about, like, my parents don't think about it. Other parents don't think about it because they were taught to chip away and to take away the humanity from their children. There's no other way that you can hit a child without removing a piece of their humanity from them. Because what it is, you did something wrong to me, I'm going to vilify you. And because I'm doing that, I'm taking away your humanity. And now I can hit you because you have become a villain in my life. Well, when we vilify somebody, we take away their humanity. And that's what Dobson taught an entire generation, multiple generations to do. Same with Falwell and all the other people. And because they can
translate that to those people coming across the border, they're not human, or at least they're not fully human. Mm-hmm. Those Islamic people, you know, mm-hmm. they're not a full human in my view. I can have some compassion for them, so I can love them to try to make them us. Boy, mm-hmm. it's just such a powerful thing to understand, like that dehumanization, that teaching that flesh is evil. So mm-hmm. the things we do absolutely naturally as human beings, I mean, we should be laughing with our children and saying, of course you masturbate, of course you do, because your sex drive is as strong as your will to survive, is as strong as your need to eat. So of course you're going to explore that. Mm-hmm. Why would I punish you for that? Now, I'm, you know, on the eating side, if you eat 16 chocolate bars in a day, I'm going to say that's not really the way we want to live. And so yeah. we can make those conversations about sexuality or anything else. But I really believe, like, when we look at issues like the trans issue today, a big part of what we're seeing are Christians saying, well, why do you get to be free to be who you are? I don't get to be free to be who I am. Why don't you have to suffer in a lack of identity like I do? You don't get to be free because I'm not free. But wasn't it the mission statement of Jesus that he came to set the captives free? And I don't yep. think it set them free from sin. It was set them free from those religious guys who want to be self-righteous and tell you they're good and you're not. And it's so dehumanizing. You are dead on. I have to look at my child as less than human to be able to commit an act of violence against them.
And it snowballs. And that's why you see so many adult children no contact with their parents, because to this day, I am not a full human person in the eyes of my parents. They still talk to me. Just they still treat me, especially since I'm one of those liberals or Democrats being pro-choice, that gave them permission to not give me my humanity back in their eyes, because their doctrine believes that this is so horrible and it doesn't deserve to be recognized as good behavior, let alone Christ-like. When I don't know where I stand on substitutional atonement, but I can say that for a really long time before I say escaped, because when you're in a cult, you don't just leave. I lost everything. Before I escaped, I remember talking about this with my husband and some trusted people, that I don't think that Jesus came to die for our sins. He came to show us what happens when religion takes over. And religion and cult ideologies, again, like, I love how you said it, it was not Jewish people. It was this fringe religious cult ideology that put him up on the cross. And whether or not he is the Son of God, substitutional atonement, I just think that we got a whole lot of things wrong in this book. And if we look at who he is, what he spoke out against, I know you're dead on that he was for the freedom of people.
Yeah.
Full stop. That's what he was for.
And the affirmation of people as to who they are, not who they need to become.
Yeah. You know,
I love, you know, in my performative speaking times, you know, I will ask, who knows John 3:16, you know, and everybody knows John 3:16. And I say, who knows John 3:17? And much fewer hands will go up. And John 3:17 says, you know, God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but that through him, the world might be saved. And when you really break down that sentence into its original language, you know, that saved is the word sozo, which is a word I love. And sozo, that we translate healed or saved or salvation, does not mean say a magic prayer and you're going to heaven. That is not what sozo means. It's very similar. It's a Greek word, very, very similar to the Jewish word shalom. It's about wholeness. It's having a fullness of your identity and being reconnected to your original purpose. And I really believe, and you're right on that, Jesus came to say, you know, this religion is not good for you. But I think even more so, the message of the story of Jesus is like, the Spirit of heaven lives in you. You are amazing. You have potential to do incredible things. All you need to know, all you need is to be released from the bondage of religion that tells you you're bad and understand that you are divinely connected to something amazing out there. And I think, you know, in the culture of the day, they defined that as a, you know, a patriarchal authority or a king. But the truth is, it's like, I really look at it like we are eternal and finite, and I don't exactly know why or how that works. But I think Jesus was saying, I want to show you what it looks like when we learn how to be connected to our eternal self and understand that we carry that Spirit here so we can make it on earth as it is in heaven. And he wasn't saying, nobody comes to the Father but through me, like you have to join my religion and claim that I'm God and all these. He was saying, you start to understand that this divine Spirit is in you and it makes you live above your base self. Mm. Whereas we have Christian nationalism say, your base self is good. Live as your base. Donald Trump, like, be a racist. Yes, absolutely. And people are like, yes, this guy is giving me permission to be a horrible person. Jesus was saying, once you understand who you are, you can't help but live at a better version of yourself and constantly be renewing your mind, Romans 12:2, and being transformed into what is good and right today and letting go of the things that we used to hold to for our safety, value, and purpose. So it's a, I think the story of Jesus is amazing, and I never argue at all anymore of whether he was God or not God. Whether he really even existed or didn't exist. I don't know. The story is so radical and so inspiring and so standing against the status quo, sitting with the woman at the well, the immigrant, the half-breed that his own people despised, and a woman no less. Ugh, women were even worse, you know, the worst version of that. Defending the woman caught in adultery, going to have lunch with Zacchaeus. This is a radical fucking story. I tell Christians, if you don't have religious people saying you're too kind to sinners, you are not a follower of Jesus, because that was the constant criticism of Jesus. You're too kind to sinners. And so sozo is the thing. It is, how do I get reconnected to my eternal identity and purpose that makes me start to strive to be the best version of myself that I can be.
It's beautiful. I had mentioned a couple times that we were going to talk about this. When did you start to see that shift? So it's a twofold question. When did you see that? Because I know we don't have too much time left. And then what was that? I cannot believe I'm going to say this. What was that stirring in your soul that caused, like, it's so difficult for me to do that. Was that stirring? Because all I can hear is Jen Johnson saying that, like singing that over and over and over again for 25 minutes.
Yeah. But, yeah. Not manipulation at all, though.
Absolutely not. No, we are not going to get that in your brain over and over again. Nope. Yeah. Not through music. Not happening today. But really, because what I've said is, we talked prior to this, and I know that you went to the National Prayer Breakfast. You were at the table, you were in the room where it happens, and then now you are not. So that's a distinct, you're in the room where things happen. You're not next to Bill Johnson or at the National
Although
Prayer
we were at the table with Ted Cruz and Nancy Pelosi. So
first off, was that on purpose? Because that makes me cry on behalf of Pelosi, laugh hysterically on behalf of Cruz. What are they like?
I'm judging people on a very brief encounter. I did meet Ted Cruz's father on a much more longer basis, and he was a major asshole. I just can tell you that. Sorry, I didn't mean to make you spit out your drink. National Prayer Breakfast. My wife was elected as a mayor of our city. Fresno, California is the fifth largest city in California. So it's a, you know, it's a fairly sizable city, and she was the mayor, we haven't had a Republican in a statewide office in California since Arnold Schwarzenegger. And the person that came closest to winning a statewide election as a Republican is my wife. She lost by 8,000 votes of being the state controller. All these Seven Mountains people, if people know about, I know you talk about Seven Mountains theology, wanted to connect to us. So Lance Wall now, and all of these people were reaching out to us. And my wife and I were just people who look at, and Fresno is sort of in the conservative part of California. And Fresno was a city where we were so proud of getting Christians elected as mayor and sheriff and police chief and judges and all of these things. But our city is one of the most impoverished cities in the state of California. Mm-hmm. And so my wife and I were like, well, how can we be Christian and our city be shit? That doesn't make sense. How can we have this many churches and things not being changed for the better? And so we were motivated through our faith in Jesus that Jeremiah 29:7 says, pray for the city to which I've sent you, and in its welfare, you'll find your welfare. And we were like, oh, we're supposed to change things for the better in our city. And that is the gospel being preached. And we were shocked to find out not all Christians believe that. So we were motivated to change things. Long way of getting to, and so we got invited to the National Prayer Breakfast. We sat 8 feet from Barack Obama and at a table with Nancy Pelosi and Ted Cruz. So to answer your question after that long ramble, Nancy Pelosi is one of the most awkward human beings I've ever been around in my life. And I think you can see it when she talked, yes. You know, she was just awkward. And it was kind of interesting because we were at the table and we met Ted Cruz's dad. Then Ted came and he was sitting there, and there was this Czechoslovakian couple that could, I don't think they could even speak English. And so there was one chair, and we're like, oh, who's going to be here? And we knew at this prayer breakfast, it was always a Republican and a Democrat at each table. And so we're like wondering who's going to be here. And all of a sudden this young lady walks up and she says, Leader Pelosi will be here shortly. And we're like, So Nancy and Ted were at the table, and, you know, Ted, if you just met him on the street, you would say, you know, decent guy. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, Nancy, Representative Pelosi, let me speak of both of them with honor, and Senator Cruz, both, she had grandchildren that lived in Houston. And so they began to have a conversation about Houston, and it went very well. But now knowing, and by the way, while we were back there, we were taken to meet Doug Coe. Do you know who Doug Coe is?
Yeah, the family.
The leader, right? Of the family. Mm-hmm. Yes. Weirdest moment of my entire life. Okay, I got to tell this real fast. We were taken into this hotel suite, and they're like, Doug will be with you shortly. Like everybody was whispering, Doug will be with you shortly. And I mean, if you believe in the spiritual stuff, my skin was crawling. I'm like,
yeah,
there are demons all over this place. I was just like, this is horrible. And we were taken into this room, and this guy was sitting in this high backed chair with like a young women standing on each side.
Of course.
And we were on this couch, and he like basically gave my wife this small glass globe, and like, you are part of the family. And I mean, it was like meeting a mob boss. It was the weirdest fucking moment of my life. And I told my wife, we will have nothing to do with those people, nothing whatsoever to do with those people. And so that, you know, it is, it is a pursuit of power. It is a religious mm-hmm. pursuit of power. It's no different than what Caiaphas and his group did in the first century, and the people that Jeremiah said, don't listen to those prophets that are telling you we're God's favorite country and therefore Babylon's not going to take us. No, we are going to be taken. And that's where we are today. So we had that experience, saw that turn. Historically, I think that turn started happening like with Nixon in the early, you know, late 60s, early 70s, silent majority, all of these things. And I think those, it has been now, if you read books like The Power Worshipper and The Power Worshippers and Jesus and John Wayne, mm-hmm. it is a conspiracy. It has been planned. They've been pursuing
yes.
and planting the foundation of this for decades. And this didn't start with Donald Trump. This started decades ago and has been fostered and fostered and fostered by people like James Dobson, Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, who were not good people with good intentions at all. It is a horrible, dangerous movement to our society, to our country, and at a very more base level, to human beings, and we need to stand up against it at all cost and as a big fight.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. I've said this before. There are so many people that just say, oh, it can't get any worse. They're not going to do anything more than this. They're not going to, all the different things. And I just think the biggest problem that, in my opinion, one of the biggest problems that Democrats have right now is they are listening to people that did not grow up like this. Mm. And they need to be listening to people, not just Democrats, but everybody should be listening to those that were born and raised inside of this Christian nationalist evangelical movement, because we were the ones that were indoctrinated to take over. And if you listen to us, all of our voices, this deconstruction movement, this decolonization movement from this cult, from this movement, I think that's when you'll start to really put the big picture together. But yeah. that's who we were. We were the ones that were supposed to usher in the end times by creating the end times.
Right.
And
yeah. I think, to go back to your question of when I saw the shift, it Jimmy Carter is the most Christian president ever in my lifetime, by far. And Christians voted for him like crazy because he was born again. It was, you know, I remember when he mm-hmm. was running, born again became this huge conversation. But then he was wimpy as a president. So we hated him because mm-hmm. we want King David, who's going to go out there and kick some ass for us. And then maybe he'll ask forgiveness later, but he's going to kick some ass for us. Mm-hmm. We want Bruce Willis to be our leader. And so we hated Jimmy Carter for being Christ-like. We honestly hate the person that Jesus was, or the story says he was, because he's a wimp. And so we've had to make him into a white Second Amendment table overturner for justice, mm-hmm. you know, because we want a bad man to be our savior. And so Donald Trump, for as incompetent and idiotic and silly as I think he is, he somehow captured the spirit of this thing and said, hey, I can use these people. I've heard so many stories of how he like laughs behind closed doors. Like, can you believe these idiots? Can you believe Mike Pence? These guys will do whatever I say. Mm-hmm. They think I'm the Messiah. He mocks them mercilessly. But that's what James Dobson and these others taught us to do, and give yeah. this fealty to a guy like Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's very true. If one person that evangelicals believe is the person that the prophet, right? The person that God is using to communicate, the vessel. If one person, one of those people says that's the chosen person, that's who God has appointed, it's done. And that's exactly what Falwell did at Liberty University. And here we are. And no one will contest that.
We love that Elijah killed all the prophets of Baal. You know, we love that you know, all of this killing and bloodshed of what we have colonizingly called the Old Testament, which is actually Hebrew scripture. So when Donald Trump says, let's use violence, you know, like at the very beginning of his run, you know, he's like, you know, in the old days, we would have taken that guy outside. And, you know, that is so appealing to evangelicals.
Yes.
And so when Donald Trump calls for violence, Christians can justify violence, even though their leader in the Bible is the one that said, hey, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. If you're forced to go a mile, go two. If somebody sues you for your cloak, give them your tunic. A totally opposite message to that. But yes, if Donald Trump becomes president, or maybe even more so, if he doesn't, if he gets arrested, he goes to prison for his crimes, and he calls for violence, I think the evangelicals are prepared and ready to go and rise up, and we will see violence from this Christian community. Now, I'm sorry, if I can, let me put one message of hope in here. I really believe we're in a time like Jeremiah and Jesus, and I think their messages were very concurrent of, oh yeah, things are going to get bad. Like Jesus, they're like, Jesus, look at this temple. Isn't this amazing? And he says, oh, not one stone of that thing is going to stand on another. And I'm always struck that he didn't say, pray that God relents and that doesn't happen. No, he didn't say that. He said, this is happening. This thing is crumbling down. Jeremiah is like, no, we are going to be ransacked by Babylon. And so I do have a fear of the pain that this Christian nationalism can cause. I guess I have this pessimistic optimism that this is sort of how the course of human events go, and human systems wind down, and the evangelical influence, this is like, it's, you know, we're going to pry that influence from their cold, dead hands. And in a generation, I don't think it's going to, if it even exists anymore, it's not going to have any influence, because our younger people are going to say, wow, that thing brought calamity on us and we need to change. And I'm not sure change happens in humans in any other way. I mean, no, it can. I shouldn't say that. It absolutely can. But our system now has so much financial incentive for people like Lance Wallnau and Sean Foyt and Donald Trump, and to a great degree, the Democrats as well. You know, we don't have national health care because the healthcare companies give them a lot of money. So maybe we need some societal and systemic collapse for real change to come. And so while I fear the pain that could cause us all and the people harmed in that, I also am a little bit in like, oh no, this is going to be good. We need no stone to be left on top of another on this thing, maybe. So just if I can give some hope, this may be exactly what needs to happen. This may be just another human cycle where things come crumbling down, so we very messily improve as a species, if that's possible.
I agree. I've been saying for a while that because people like me that were raised by Dobson, that were raised by this system, this white nationalism, Christian nationalism, I think it's us that are rising up and saying, you're done. We're not going to raise our kids like this. We're going to speak out. The generation of the strong-willed children, we're speaking out and we're holding people accountable. It's not just Dobson. We're holding all religious leaders accountable. Everybody that our family, that our parents, that our caregivers looked to learn how to hate us and call it love, we're calling them out. And I don't believe that we're seeing revival. We're seeing reformation. Historically, it happens roughly every 500 years. We're overdue for reformation. So that's what I think that we're seeing. And I think it's going to come from ex-evangelicals and people that still believe in love in whatever capacity that looks like. I mean, I was always told to stay away from atheists because they're satanic, which is interesting because those are two totally separate things. But
they literally don't believe in Satan.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They literally just they don't believe in anything. They have become some of the most wonderful people to me. And I think that whatever the powers that be, I say that because I have just so many different people that listen. So whether they believe in Jesus or not believe in Jesus or not believe in God or whatever, when we're all gathered together for one cause of love, there's something really amazing that happens with the human condition and the human spirit. I think that's reformation.
Yeah.
That's what I chase after.
If I can just say, and I say this as a colleague, not as a patriarchal, patronizing old man. Like,
yeah.
I just think what you're doing is spectacular. I think you're packaging it so well. I think that's what we have to do to get the message across and the things you're doing. I just love it and am rooting you on and championing you and the things that you've said in our conversation. They are so powerful. I almost want to, like, in a very cringy way, say, for such a time as this, Stephanie.
I say that all the time as a joke. For such a time as this, you've been called.
For my wife, you know, so many times they would say, you're here for such a time as this. And I would tell my wife, like, you're not an Esther. You are not an Esther. Yeah. Esther gained power because she was hot and good in bed. And I'm not saying my wife's not hot and good in bed. I'm just saying that's not why she acquired power. So I would say you are David. You are a king and a priest and powerful. And yes, so you're not Esther. You are
powerful and
carry an authority and a creativity to deliver that to others. So
I really appreciate
thank you for
that.
What you do. It's very important.
Thank you. I wanted to ask, because I know you had to go. I have three questions I ask everybody. What's your favorite book? What's your favorite song, which is always like choosing a favorite child, and your favorite movie? And then I guess I'm going to add a fourth. Are you working on anything right now?
Oh my gosh. My favorite book changes all the time. I'm supposed to say the Bible, right?
What book in the Bible? That's right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I'm actually what I'm reading right now. I put it on my shelf just a minute. It's a book called Mary Magdalene by a guy named Reza. But the book that really impacted my life most recently was a book by Malcolm Gladwell called Talking to Strangers. And so when somebody wants to think about decolonizing and why they think the way they do, it's just a very cleverly crafted way of challenging our thought processes and all of those things. So I love that book. Favorite song. Yes, that is like picking a child. So I went to high school in Western Nebraska. I had a friend that worked at this place in Colorado, northeastern Colorado, called Red Rocks. And one day he said, "Hey, you want to go to a concert with me at Red Rocks?" And I'm like, "Sure, let's go." And you know, it's like, "Who's the band?" And he's like, "Oh, it's this Irish band that I've never heard of them before. It's like U2, I think, or something like that." And so I, never having heard of U2, in 1982, I went to a concert and saw Bono and the group sing "Sunday Bloody Sunday." They actually filmed the video for the song "Sunday Bloody Sunday" there. And so that song, which I love the song in and of itself, but that whole story around it probably makes it my favorite song ever. I love U2, have always loved U2. Favorite movie, gosh, that is a real hard one. Like, honestly, it's Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I think it's the most well-made,
I love that,
funniest, most poignant movie from the 80s that I love. A Few Good Men I watch all the time too.
That's good too.
I love that. And then I'm actually having some people over at my house next week to watch the movie Jojo Rabbit. If you've never seen Jojo Rabbit, you've got to see Jojo Rabbit. I love it so much. And was there one more? Oh, am I working on?
What are you working on? So, are you Yeah.
I wrote a novel in 2017. And so, oh, well, this is not a video thing. Called Joseph Comes to Town, which was my vision of what Jesus would say if he were incarnate on earth today to the evangelical church. We're rebranding the book now, and we're calling it Religious Right, Religiously Wrong, a Modern Day Parable. And I love it so much. It is the baby, other than my children, of my life. And so my website is pastor-paul.com, and people can find out about it there, order the book on Amazon. And make sure you put that dash in between. It's pastor-paul.com. Otherwise, if you go to pastor-paul.com, you go to a really crazy person's website.
So. Yeah. And I'll link everything down below too in the note. Awesome. Everybody, please go and give Pastor Paul a follow. He's just got really great content, cross platforms. Truly an honor to have you here today. And I hope to have you back in the future, and we can talk more as the election starts really progressing. We can really get into the psychology behind that from the evangelical perspective. So,
yeah, thank you so much. My honor as well. And your kind words just mean everything. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for listening. Please make sure that you are kind to yourself and to others. If you are interested in supporting this show, please click the link at the bottom to my Patreon. These shows take a lot of time and resources, and any support is appreciated. If you are interested in being a guest, please email the show at focusonyourownfamilypodcast@gmail.com. Inside of the show notes, you will find the links to mine and the guests' socials. Please give us a follow. We look forward to talking with you and connecting with you.